I recognise the new diploma when I was 12 years old.
Okay.
When I was 10, I had, that's 1942, I had a farmer that gave me a job stacking hay and driving a tractor while they loaded it. And I had a daylight permit, driver's license, so I could drive a truck or anything.
How old
on the
you?
Road, 10.
Uh-huh.
I drove any kind of equipment
yeah,
they had.
My uncles did that too.
So were you on a farm then?
Yeah.
How big? What did you raise?
Well, we owned 27 acres, but my mother leased it out. My dad died when I was 5. And we went to Arizona for a year before that because of his health. And then at 5 we moved back to Kenai's, but she had leased out our farm, so we just had, well, maybe an acre and a half. We had probably 30 apple trees, and chicken coop, and a pen for cows. And
so you had some cows then?
We had
Was it mostly just
one
eating
cow.
Yourself, or were you also selling?
What?
Was it mostly just taking care of your family, or was it also selling something?
No, just taking care of our family.
Oh, really? Wow.
But
what year were you born?
1932.
Wow, so right at the beginning of the Depression.
Yeah.
Were you born in Kenosh?
Yes, in our home. And in 42, when I went to work for this farmer, as all older men that was working there, but they was making $1 a day, is what the wages was. But when we received our first paycheck from stacking hay and working, we got $1 an hour. I got $1 an hour. The other farmers that was working for him says, "This isn't fair. You're paying him the same wage you're paying us." And he says, "Well, he's doing as much work as you guys are."
You're 10 years old.
Yeah. I was, when we'd stack hay, I'd be up on a haystack, and they had a derrick that had four posts going up, and then the center pole went up with an angle board, and a pulley on the top and a pulley on the bottom of it. And then it came down to the bottom of the derrick, and then we had the tractor would hook onto it and pull that fork up, and then it'd swing around and it'd drop it on hay on the haystack, and then I'd move it around and stack it and tromp it down while he was bringing more hay.
Wow.
And then when we get through that, I'd get on the tines of the, I don't know what it's called. It's the teeth that pick up the hay.
Oh yeah.
And it'd lower me back down, and I'd drive the tractor back out in the field, and we'd load another load, and then we'd go back in again. But I did that.
And you're 10 years old, and that was 1942.
42, all the guys was in Second World War. The reason is wages went from $1 a day to $1 an hour.
Yeah. What were your memories of that time? What was life like? Was your dad at home? Or?
No, by that time my dad had died.
Oh, so
we moved back after my dad died, when he was 5. Before that, we lived there, but I don't remember it. I went to school. We walked to school. Interesting, we had 2 blocks to the school, but we had about 14 inches of snow on the ground in the wintertime. And my neighbor, who was the bishop of the ward, would come around and we'd get a hold of the horse's tail, and one after another, the horse would kind of break the snow trail and take us to school, and we'd all have hold hands and go into school. So
how old were you when your dad died?
5.
5. So do you have any memories of him?
Yes, he was in bed, always in bed.
Oh, so he was sick with something.
And he's really sick. And everybody'd say, "Shh, don't make a noise, don't disturb Dad."
So how many kids?
I was the youngest of six.
And your mom raised six kids without
Yes.
husband? Wow.
I had one brother and four sisters. And then when we moved to Provo.
And how old were you then?
I was 12. And we...
What brought you to Provo, by the way?
I don't know.
Your mom just picked
just
up and moved.
Sold her house and thought it'd be a better chance for education than that here than down in Kanawha. But I got involved with scouting, and we went on a lot of trips and built igloos. And when I was 14, we started Sea Scouts.
Oh, really?
Like the Explorers, only the Sea Scouts.
Did you have to go somewhere?
We had a dry land ship we would set up in a culture hall of the chapel.
Uh-huh.
But we had a rowboat, a canoe, a kayak, two rubber rafts, and I don't know what else.
Would you go out on the lake? Or
out on Provo, Utah Lake.
So where was your neighborhood that you lived in back then?
I lived where R.C. Willie's outlet store is, on First West and between First and Second North.
Oh, okay.
You know where Smith's is?
Yeah.
Across the street from Smith's, just second house in the corner, but they built a strip mall in there where our house was.
Yeah. Was the Provo City Hall in that area back then, or?
Provo City Hall was...
Because that's just around the corner from where it is now.
Well, the... I don't know where it was.
Okay.
The fire station was where it was. Is at now. And then the school was right next to it, Provo High School. And that's where the city and county building, not that's where the Provo City building is now,
yeah.
Where you pay your utility bill. But that, that was all Provo High, that block.
Oh.
And they tore it down and built the southern after I left, got out of it.
So you pretty much grew up in Provo, and then when did you move away? Was that when you went off to the Army?
I went in the service. I found out that they was going to draft me as soon as I got out of high school. And I was in 51.
And that was drafting for the Korean War.
For the Korean War.
Yeah.
And so I went, the principal was the skipper of a Sea Scout ship.
Oh, huh.
He was the principal of high school, but he's also the skipper of the Sea Scout ship. And I went and talked to him, and I found out I was going to be drafted. And I told him I don't want to be drafted. So I want you to figure up when I've got enough unit credit to graduate, and I want to join the service before I get drafted. And so...
What was the benefit of doing that versus getting drafted? A better chance of being an officer or something like
no,
that?
No, just I wanted to take and didn't want to be drafted.
Oh.
I just, the stigma.
You wanted to be your choice.
It was my choice, not theirs.
Gotcha. Huh.
And I went to Hawaii to my basic training, guerrilla basic. We knew exactly we was going right straight to Korea after we left Hawaii. And I came back to school for leadership school after I had my basic training and went to Fort Ord, California. And I was there for 12 weeks while I was taking up leadership school. Mm-hmm. But I really didn't want to, but my commanding officer more or less made it a point that he called me and sat me down and talked to me, and he says, if you don't do it for yourself, you owe it to your mother. You need to go back to there. You'll at least get to spend a week or two on leave at home before you go to Fort Ord to your school. And I says, okay, but I'm going to write a letter asking permission to be, you know, dropped from school and go to Korea, which I did. But they hid the letter until after leadership was over.
Why did you do that?
Just bullheadedness. When you're a kid, you do a lot of things that you don't know why. After you grow up. But I went to, after I got our old leadership school, they held me there and put me in a color guard because I wanted to go to Korea and get with some of the guys that I'd had basic training with.
Oh, okay.
And they went through another section of leadership school, and then they finally let me go after they graduated, and I went to Korea.
It sounds like you were active in Scouts. Were you active in the church at that age too?
Yes.
Did you have any girlfriends, friends? Did you know any crazy things before then, before you were drafted?
I had all kinds of friends. In high school, we would have, in the fall of the year, we'd go out and one of the guys would get a couple of bushels of corn, and corn on the cob. Somebody would get maybe a ham or something else, and we'd have a party. We'd really have a party. And it wasn't boyfriend, girlfriend, it just everybody wanted to come.
Did you have favorite things that you did when you were in high school? Were you into recreation or going into the mountains or anything, like fishing? Or?
I started out in the sixth grade.
Uh-huh.
Playing the Aldo sax.
Oh, is that where Julian gets?
I think it's where he started from. And my band teacher gave me private lessons too. Rex Sutherland is his name, and he, if you ever have a teacher that stands out above all the others, he was probably the one for me.
You know what's really funny? Sorry, I don't want to interrupt your story, but one of my favorite teachers throughout all of my, you know, elementary school, high school was my band teacher. So uh-huh. I understand that.
But he taught me in the sixth grade, and in the seventh and eighth grade, was in junior high.
Yeah.
And I went to Fair Junior High.
Yeah.
On 7th Eastern Center in Provo. And when I graduated from eighth grade, in 1947, they had a church centennial for 100 years.
Uh-huh.
1947, they had a all high school band from all over Utah that marched in that parade in Salt Lake on the 24th of July. And my band teacher called the conductor of the all high school band and told him he wanted to be in that high school band, even though I wasn't in high school. And so I went up to one of the high schools up there, and we was going to audition and see where we played and practice some music. We was all sitting in that band room, and we were in the culture hall, and these other sax players, oh boy, they was giving me a bad time. What do you think you're doing here? You don't belong here. All this stuff. And the band teacher walked in. I'd never seen him before. And he said, "Whoa, stop, that's not going to happen to any of my, you know, classes, things I'm involved with. And being that you're having problems with the sex, you're going to have tryouts and see where each of you fit in this sax. There's, I think, 8 saxophone players, alto sax players. Well, I was the second guy in the first chair. So one guy beat me out.
Wow, that shut them up.
They never said another thing after that. But that was really a highlight in my life, to be able to play in that.
And that was Utah Centennial.
Yeah, when they came into Utah. Yeah.
Cool. So were you actually in a marching band for that? Or?
Yeah, it was 146 guys. High school kids from all over the state.
Except for you, because you weren't in high school yet.
Yeah, I was the only one that wasn't in high school.
Cool.
But we marched down State Street to 7th South and over to Liberty Park and from Biggie Mung's statue there on West Temple.
Oh, yeah.
State. But that's one of the few things. When I was in high school, in the summertime, I went up in Idaho and worked on a farm up there. I started out working for my cousin, and he had 250 acres, about 180 of it was irrigated, the rest of it was dry land and mountains. And we did everything, wheat, hay. We'd get up 4 o'clock in the morning, go out and milk and feed the animals. And,
wow.
Be through by 7:30, we'd go eat, and at 8 o'clock we'd go out and work in the fields.
Wow.
A day, and then about 5:30 at night we'd come home and go out and do the chores. And, as soon as we get through the chores, we'd go eat, go to bed. That was, we just did it.
Was that a summer job that you did?
All the time I was out of school.
Oh.
And I did that.
What part of Idaho was that?
Grace, Idaho.
Oh,
by Labra Hot Springs.
Really? My mother-in-law is from there.
Is that right?
Yeah, she grew up in Grace. Did you ever go to the
Soda Springs?
Did you ever go to the Spud Nut Shop in Grace?
They didn't have it when I was there.
Oh, okay. Her dad
51.
Her dad ran the Spud Nut Shop and the post office, I think.
Okay.
In Grace.
Okay. I know probably the building it was in. But we lived out in Store Route, outside of Grace. But I worked up there 3 years. And
just for your information, did you ever see Ruby from Napoleon Dynamite?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was filmed in Preston, which is not too far from Grace.
Yeah, Preston. I went through Preston to get there. Now, for the rodeo, in the fall of the year, my senior year, my boss was a pilot in the Second World War. And he got a Piper Cub, rented it, and we flew from Grace to Preston.
Uh-huh.
And we went up in the air. He said, "You want to see our farm?" And I said, "Yeah." So he just took the plane, and did a nosedive, and came back across, and was flying upside down all the way across his farm.
Oh my goodness.
First, I was afraid I was going to fall out, and then I don't know gravity or what, but we hear him sitting looking at us. Uh-huh. But then he just rolled it over and was on our way to Preston.
Oh my goodness.
But that's how I was.
Is that the first time you flew?
First time I'd ever been in the airplane.
Oh, wow.
What a thrill.
So, can I ask you a question? Do you guys have questions? I keep asking them all, but I'm really curious. So, back up to when you enlisted. And then you got into the color guard. Was the color guard mainly because you'd been in band and that was kind of what you wanted to do?
I don't know. I wasn't playing an instrument. I carried the United States flag for drills any time we had to go on a parade. And I always got the, I guess because I was 6 foot tall, I don't know, but they chose me to be, you know, carry the flag.
So how soon after basic training and then that did you end up over in Korea?
Right after leadership school. Probably, it's 12 weeks of basic. And I would guess a month, month and a half, that was at Fort Ord. And then I got to Korea. Well, I went got to Japan. And they sent me to chemical radiological, it's been so long so I can't remember. CBR, chemical, biological, and radiological warfare school.
Huh.
So I was supposed to teach. The infantry guys, what it's about after I got assigned to my company. And since I found out what it was at, I got out of that. I didn't want to do that. because I didn't want to get involved with radiation. And
yeah, or biological or chemical weapons.
Yes.
Nasty.
So we left there and we headed to south end of Japan to get on the ship to come to Korea. And there's a troop train. And I got on a troop train, and there's four bunks in this car that we was assigned to because we were going to be overnight. And two of the guys that was in there says, well, there's a lieutenant going to be in here too. I said, okay, so I threw my duffel bag on the bottom bunk and took off the other end of the train. About the time the train started out, I went back and I told the officer that, hey, I'll trade you bunks. I'll get up on top bunk and you can have this one. He said, no, that's fine. You stay there. But when I got to Busan, they held me back from the other guys that were getting off. And I couldn't figure out why they was holding me back, but in a few minutes, this lieutenant came out and pointed over to me, and then he went on about his way, and a couple of guys came over and got me and put me on a different truck. And when I got up online, they took us in a tent, and he says, commanding officer will be in here in just a few minutes. But when I saw him as a lieutenant at Busan, or coming across to Busan,
uh-huh.
when we got up online and here come this commanding officer, it was the officer that I had taken his bunk going across Japan. And I, about 6 months down the road, I asked him, I says, how come I ended up in your company? Is anybody, Scott, gets enough, will take and come and take the bunk from the officer? I want him in my company. But I was assigned not in his company, but I was with the 8th Corps. What is it called?
Artillery? Infantry?
No, spearhead the tax.
Oh.
It's called a bastard outfit. They're, when that company would leave, we would stay there. And the next regiment would come in and we'd get another company. But we was always online. They didn't. I've never told war stories.
Yeah.
To any of my grandkids,
you
any
were
my
at the front,
my
like
kids.
All the time.
After I first got there, they pulled our company off, and it just, well, what had happened? This officer, this company commander, was one of 14 guys that was left in that company out of 146, 150 guys. It wasn't either killed or wounded.
Wow.
And so there were 14 guys left, and he was a second, he was a corporal in one of the squads, and they made him company commander.
Wow.
But he was going to Oranor for a week while he reorganized that company. Mm-hmm. And, but after we got there, they took us off, we were just behind the lines, and took us down to Koji Island, Kojido. And we pulled guard duty for the isolation compound. And what that is the enemy that had caused war crimes. The worst
of the worst.
Of the worst. And the first night they had me walking guard between two towers. It was kind of a pie-shaped camp for this isolation compound. And they had other camps there, but this is the one that I was involved with. And I was going between one tower and another, and along about 2:30 in the morning, three guys in uniform, dress uniform, coming walking around in the tower, and started to cross the outside of the compound. And as soon as they started my way, I says, "Halt, advance one to be recognized." He said, "I'm the company commander." And I said, "Good, you come and let me recognize you. The other two stand right there." So he came up to me, and when he got about 6 feet from me, I says, "Halt," and ask him some questions, and I'd ask him the password. When he gave it to me, I says, "All right, the other guys can come up." And he talked to me a few minutes, and then they ran on. Well, the next day I was taken off that guard post and I was putting on the gate for the isolation compound. And I stood guard on that gate for everybody that's going out and in when they take the honey buckets, empty the waste from all the latrines and the kitchen, everything. They'd take out and put them in the dump. Well, I'd let them out and in.
So was the switch from the guard duty to, was that switch a promotion or a demotion? Or
well, same rank.
Oh, okay.
But there's a lot more responsibility.
Was that because you were willing to challenge?
Because I challenged him.
Huh.
Yeah, that's, nobody ever told me. That's the only thing I could figure out.
Yeah.
But they had me on guard from 12 o'clock at night until 8 o'clock in the morning, and then I'd sleep until noon, and then I had the afternoon moon time until I'd go to work, you know.
So how long were you at that?
We were there about a month and a half.
Okay, and then where'd you go from there?
And then I went on trucks back up past Seoul to the 38th parallel. Up right up on line. We was assigned to Hill 1043. Imagine Temp is 11,000 feet. Yeah. It was just 60 feet short of Temp.
Oh, wow.
And being up on there in the wintertime, no heat, no light, no nothing. You had sea rations.
Wow.
And once every 2 weeks, we'd go down the hill and be able to just back behind that hill, and we could go and have a hot meal, and then we'd take a bath or shower, be down there for 2.5 hours, and then we'd go back up online.
Wow.
But it was, while we were there, when we first got up on that hill, a solid rock, and the command post is right on top of the hill. It was the same level, but just down just a little next to them. Because what we was assigned was a 50 caliber machine gun.
Oh, yeah.
And then a 57 recoilless rifle. But when they take in ski resorts, use a 105 recoilless rifle for avalanche control.
Yeah.
They shoot that 105 up the top of the mountain, and that causes the snow to slide, and they can control that.
Yeah.
So they don't have people hurt.
And you were manning
57. Oh. And that you put on your shoulder.
It has a tripod.
It's about this big around.
Yeah.
The shell is about that long.
Yeah.
Well, the projectile is about that long. The shell is about like this. And it has holes in the back end of that 57. Well, it's like a bazooka,
mm-hmm.
only it's got, it's just like a rifle. You close the breech and fire it. As much force goes out the back as the front, and that's why you reason to hold it.
Oh,
yeah. So there's no recoil on it. But the 57 caliber machine gun, we was to give harassing fire. Every 20 seconds we had to fire that machine gun. Sometimes it'd shoot maybe 6 bursts, sometimes 15, 20. But every 20 minutes we had to shoot at least one shot. Just to keep the enemy on their toes.
Huh.
Those
things be damaged.
Yeah. Wow. There was armored piercing shell that went with that 50 caliber machine gun. And sometimes it'd have a tracer every 5 shots. You could see the shell because it was red. You could see where he was hitting. So you knew at night exactly where he was hitting.
Huh.
Most of the time I didn't use that shell because I'd set the tripod, and in the daytime, I'd pick out the bunkers where most activity was for the enemy, and I'd read whatever the marks on the tripod was, and then I could look at that and tell exactly where I was shooting and not have to even have to look. I'd just set the tripod in it.
Huh.
Automatically hit that, and I'd shoot a few up there, and then I'd move it.
Huh.
But I never really told my kids. Julian, did I ever tell you anything about this? That's why I invited you to come in. We'd been online from about June, I guess, and it's the last part of October, middle of October, cold at night, it get down at like 18 below, and just Well, when we first got there, I'm going to go back a little bit. When we, our bunker was right next to the command post, solid rock. And so I got on the phone with the supply sergeant, like radar on MASH.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I says, I want to call 8th Corps. He says, you can't do that. I said, get him on the phone, I want to talk to him. So he got the guy on the phone. I says, I want 2 cases of dynamite, two boxes of blasting caps, a couple of rolls of fuse. They say, we can't send that to you, you're not qualified. You haven't done any blasting. I said, yeah, I have. I've been blowing stumps at home before I... Well, there's a lie. they sent it. And I told them, I said, need 14 logs, 10 feet long, at least a foot around, because we're building a bunker. Uh-huh. Well, I got the material. Here we had those logs stacked out behind the top of the hill. In the daytime, we would take and had chisels and hammers, and we'd fill a hole down about this far with that in the rock, turn the chisel every time and go down in, make holes, and then we'd...
In the solid rock?
In solid rock. Wow. And we'd take and start out, I put a half a stick of dynamite in first. Because I didn't know how much it was going to go out for.
Because you lied to get the dynamite.
Yeah. So we did that, and then we got so that we was using one stick at a time. And we put about 3 or 4 different holes. And then just before dark, right, it's after sundown, but before it got dark, we'd set that off. Then at night we'd be shoveling those loose rock out. And then the next day we'd start over again. And
so were you digging down into the rock to
into the rock.
Make your bunker more secure?
We made a bunker 8 feet wide.
Uh-huh.
And 12 feet long by 8 feet tall.
Oh, wow.
So we went down in the rock.
You dug 8 feet down into solid rock?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, I had 5 guys. Now, the guys that I had in my squad, one of them was an opera singer from South Bend, Indiana.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
One of them was a psychiatrist from Louisiana. One of them was from Bronx, New York, Brooklyn, and I'd have to say it's a bum. He
The one from Brooklyn?
He weighed probably 230 pounds, just a slob. every 2 weeks we'd give him a spit bath, scrubbing bath, because he had never wash or nothing.
Wow.
You get to the point you couldn't stand the smell, and so you'd give him a GI shower. But then the last guy I had in my squad was a rock soldier. He was 5 foot tall, a Korean. He'd been online 27 months, and he was there for the duration. Until the war was over between North and South Korea. But he was like radar. You'd hear the enemy shoot a mortar, some heavy artillery. He'd hear that about 15 seconds before any of the rest of us did.
Wow.
And so we had time to take cover or get out of the road with the incoming round. In the middle of October, I was getting so depressed. I'd been on Ornor rest and recuperation to Japan for 7 days. After about, 10 months, something like that, you get a chance to go back and get a break for 7 days.
Uh-huh.
And I'd come back from that. But I don't think anybody thought they was ever going to get out of being there online to get to come home. We thought we was all going to be killed.
Wow.
And so the morale was real low. And finally, I was making the rounds through the trenches. It was about this deep, the trenches. Our 57 recoilless rifle would probably take up about this much room on width. There's room for the machine gunner and one guy sitting beside of him to feed the ammunition and that. And I said, Jack, this is a man from South Bend, Indiana, the opera singer. I said, sing your man, River. It was clear skies, beautiful cold weather. And he sang that in that bunker about the most 5 feet around, you know. The trench ran across the back of the bunker. The guy shooting a gun that about this much room behind him to go through the trench. And he sang that, and it's so beautiful. I said, you know, it's not fair for just me to be able to hear that. Step outside in the trench. I'm just fairly above the trench. And sing some songs and see if they listen to them. We stepped out about this far away from our bunker out in the trench and started singing. Within 10 seconds, everything was quiet. You couldn't hear a shell anywhere.
So all the Americans stopped shooting?
American, the Korean, the Turks. The way is lined up, our hill came across like this. Mm-hmm. It went down into, what? 500 feet down the hill, at least, maybe yards. And then the hill came back up, and that hill ran up this way, and over this trench that went down in front of us, up to Sandbag Castle, and then it went back that way. But the Turk was on that point, and about 35 feet down, going across opposite us, is where the North Koreans saw us, and the Cambodians, and some Chinese. And
so how far away were they from your bunker?
It was about 1,000 feet.
Wow. So they stopped shooting, Americans stopped shooting?
Everybody, and all the way down our line, all the way down their line. You could not hear another round. And he sang there, he sang opera, he sang classical, country, every type of music.
Wow.
And his voice carried because it was so cold. And on top of that hill, you had kind of an echo coming back from his voice because, I mean, he really let it go. He really blasted out his voice.
Beautiful.
And it stayed like that for all the time he was singing. I never heard another round after about 10 seconds, maybe 15 seconds at the most. And this went on after he finally says, "I can't sing anymore." And he stopped. And the rest of the night, he wasn't a shot fired. Wow. Water on, nothing. Just silent. No, you couldn't even hear anybody talking.
Wow.
And as the sun, it was, it started to get light before the sun came up, I thought, well, it's going to start again as soon as they see. But it didn't until about 9 o'clock in the morning. And then somebody down the line took a shot, and it repeated back and forth. And by 9 o'clock, it was back to normal. But that was quite an experience for me to realize that music could cause that effect on me. Was you going to ask a question?
Was there a follow-up to that story, too?
Yes, and that's the reason I started telling it. I never told it. 2 or 3 years ago, I went to Pinedale, Wyoming. My granddaughter had been to Girl State, and she was chosen one of 3 girls and 3 boys to go to this special school. You guys know what it is. Where they go and it's learning government, and I don't know what all they do.
Was that your sister?
Move those pillows if you want. But we went out, my wife and me went out to hear her talk. The Veterans of Foreign Wars was putting on in November 11th, Veterans Day, they was having a celebration. Yeah. And she was going to talk, be one of the speakers in that celebration. And so we went out to hear her. And the night before that, she says, "Grandpa, I've asked you all the time, every time I..." Well, she grew up here with us. "Every time I'd ask you, tell me a war story, you'd never tell me a war story. I need to hear a war story."
Which granddaughter was this, by the way?
That's Angela Kendrick. Okay. That's Paula's girl. And I'd never told any of my kids any kind of war stories. I've never told them to lead up to this. But I thought, I don't know, maybe it's inspiration or what, I told her this story. Him singing and about him stopping bothering that. So she gave her talk in the meeting, and after the meeting at high school, the auditorium is full of veterans that have been invited to attend, and all the school was there. And the Veterans of Foreign Wars was having a luncheon down the hall, and invited Angela to go to lunch with them. And so she went to lunch with them. And after they was just about through eating, one of the ladies across the room asked her, "Angela, how come that you are so interested in the veterans? You've worked in soup kitchens for the Veterans of Foreign Wars, American Legion, you've helped every chance you get, you've come and done something for the veterans." And she said, "Well, my family is, some of them was in the Army, some of them in the Marines. My aunt was in the Navy. Tell us a war story." And so she told the story that I told you. and she got about halfway through, a lady across the room, and there was about between 40 and 50 people in the room. She started shaking and crying, sobbing, tears running down her face. And as soon as she got through, this lady came running across the room, took hold of Angela's hand. She says, "You know, your grandfather, by getting that man to sing, saved my brother's life. He had the gun up to his head and he was going to shoot himself because he couldn't take any more. He says, nothing in this world is worth what I'm having to go through."
Wow.
And then he heard his first song. He put his gun down and listened. By the time he got through singing, he said, "Boy, there is something worth living for."
Wow.
And he didn't shoot himself.
Wow.
And so if one person could be affected by that, and I know how I was affected by it, I thought maybe it won't hurt to take and tell that story. Because there had to be other people that felt the same way I did, because I didn't think he was ever going to get out of there.
Wow. Well, thank you for taking the time to share that story with us. Now we've got it recorded. I'm really excited about that. I wanted to ask you about your meeting Karma and that, but I think we probably want to wrap it up here because we're running a little bit late.
I met Karma a week before I went in the service.
Oh, really?
On a Monday night. All the way through high school, I'd been getting this Dolan Pugh, was his name, a date, blind date.
Uh-huh.
And we'd always go out in different places and do things. Well, when he found out that I was going to service, he says, "I'm going to get you one blind date before you go in." And so I thought, well, a week, I can just go in the service and it'll be over. You know, I won't have to keep seeing her after that. So
see how men are.
So that's how I met Karma, on a blind date. The girl that was going to go with his girlfriend had come. At the last minute, she backed out. And so she went over next two doors and asked Karma to come and go.
So how did you stay in touch?
Just letters.
Really? So you liked each other enough right at the beginning, you knew that you had to stay in touch.
I think the third day, we had a date every night for 7 days.
Wow.
And the third day I knew I was going to marry her.
Wow.
We had 27 dates before we got married.
Wow.
After the 7 days that I was home on leave going to Fort Ord, 7 days before, and then there's about 7 days after I came home.
Yeah. So how long were you in Korea before you came back and saw Karma?
About a year.
Wow.
But you rotated out of Korea with 36 points, supposedly 36 points. Some of the guys had 44, 46, 48 points, and they were still there. And General Mark Clark was assigned to take over. And as soon as he found out that there was guys in there, he says, "Everybody with 36 points will be rotated by the end of the month, October." And I rotated with 39 points. I was one of the last to rotate out of there.
Can I ask you one last question? So you said you went to church all your life before you went to Korea. Did people know you were Mormon when you were in Korea? I mean, did that affect the way you... Did you come
out? Not really. There's four of us. I have to go back. There's four of us that had mission calls to go on a mission from the Second Ward in Provo. And by the time is January, February come up, the draft board had canceled and only let two missionaries go out from our ward.
So you were one of the ones that got a mission call?
I got a call, but I didn't get to go.
Oh, wow.
The bishop boy and one of his counselors got to go. And I was... discouraged, upset that it was the bishop boy and the counselor boy that got to go. And they put my name back in the draft, and that's how I knew that I was going to be drafted.
And that's when you decided to...
That's why I took it.
Instead. That makes a lot of sense.
So, I made one phone call from Hawaii when I finished my basic training to Karma. And I think it cost me 3 minutes, $36.
Wow. Huh.
And that was a lot when back then. Months wages. But I don't know.
So can you, do you mind? You don't have to, but if you would, is there, do you have a testimony you'd like to share about the gospel? I mean, that sounds like that.
I really do. And you know, after I got back, we got married, civil marriage. And we'd been married for 6 years before I could feel at peace with the bishop and his counselors for not letting us go on a mission. And so we didn't go to the temple for 6 years after we was married. One time when I was in Korea, or in Japan, going to this school, CBR school, I met an LDS, another soldier there, and the two of us had the sacrament and had a sacrament meeting in a closet in a barrack. But I went to every church that I could find, trying to find something better, because I was disgusted with what had happened.
Yeah.
And I always came away with something missing. I didn't know what it was. But when I came back to Fort Lewis after I came back to the States.
I know where that is.
I went to church the first time, and I knew what it was. The Holy Ghost was there, and I felt it, and I knew. And then, things have happened in my life that there's no way I could deny the church now. I know that God lives, that he answers our prayers, that he looks after us. I've been driving down the road. The Spirit said to get off the road. I pulled the car over and stopped about 100 feet from the corner. And I thought, why did I stop? And I put it back in gear, and before I got a chance to start out, the car came around the corner, came all the way across his lane, crossed the other lane, clear into the parking lane where I was at. And if I'd have been up another 10 feet, he would have hit me.
Wow.
But he came in the parking lane and across and back, and he's gone. He was really speeding.
Wow.
You got time for one more?
I do, but if you guys need to go, you're welcome to go. I'd love to just keep recording.
What time is it?
8:30.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you guys
so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
See you, Zach. Mm-hmm. See you, Danny. I'm ready for it.
I was laying floor clippings out just north of Tooele. Starts with an A. There's a golf course, and right on that golf course, on the west side of the golf course, CJ Construction was building a big home there. And I'd been working on the home all week, Friday night, well, Friday afternoon, about 2 o'clock. I was just finishing up carpet. I knew I'd have it done that day. I was going to stay until I got it done. I had the master bedroom to do and one other room, and I think the hallway I was working on. And there was two guys out, it's a two-story house, and two guys out, one on one end and one on the other end, had ladders up, and then they had ladder jacks and scaffolding going clear across the house, and the house was probably, I'd guess 50 feet, I don't know, across. But that scaffolding is longer than I've ever seen. And all of a sudden the wind started coming in. Gray clouds, you know, in the east. And, it started blowing. All of a sudden, big gusts came, took boxes of siding, scattered all over the golf course, blew their ladders out about this far from the house, and there wasn't much more, and it had been gone on over. Nick came back and hit the house. And I opened the window and told him, I says, hey, why don't we take a tire rope around your scaffolding, bring it through the window and nail it to the 2x4 on the floor so that it can't blow your scaffolding out or your ladders out so you don't fall. He says, oh, we'll just fight it. We'll hang on as we go. I went in the back bedroom, knelt down and said a prayer. Father in heaven, if these guys are dumb enough that they'll risk their lives just to try to get this job done, please bless them because of their families and their wives so that they're not injured in this storm that's coming in. And I don't know what all else I said, but I could really feel a spirit I've never felt before or since so strong as I did then. The joy and love that I felt. And I always wore a short sleeve shirt. I went downstairs and CJ was coming in the kitchen as I went in to get a drink of water. He says, what's happened to you? I says, nothing, why? He says, look at your skin. And it was gray, almost transparent. And he was a high councilman for a ward out in Orem. And so I told him what had happened. But by that time, the wind had divided and made a Y around that house where it was at. And the dark cloud had gone both ways, but there was no air at all moving where we was at.
Wow.
So that he realized that. And I told him what had happened. And he just shook his head. And boy, he says, you've made up for it now. So the rest of the day, that made a funnel. It could come in like this, and then it just funneled. Across, it came across the golf course, just in one place, and then it divided where it was, that house. And until about 6 o'clock, and then the storm was over. But it's in August that I was working on that house. And it was so hot that I was sweating to beat band up on that second floor, no insulation in the ceiling and the sun blaring down. And I thought, boy, I don't know if it's worth praying for something that you don't really want. But that's the story. I've had so many things happen like that I know the gospel's true.
I just want to share with you, when you shared that experience of feeling that love and that prayer, I had an experience like that when I was in my 30s, and in a prayer, and it was the most amazing thing that has ever happened to me, and I know exactly what you mean. It's indescribable.
This is like, Heavenly Father is blessing me because I was concerned about families.
Yeah, yeah. And you could feel His love.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Well, I want to thank you for taking so much time to share those stories and letting us record them.